Well, I think the companies, not just AstraZeneca, have to continue to adhere to what they've already said in a public pledge released last week to follow the usual rigorous standards for safety and effectiveness that the FDA pursues. The FDA is not perfect, no agency is, but that's a gold standard. And that is not just for the benefit of the drug companies, but presumably it's a benefit for the public. So I think that's crucial here. And unfortunately, President Trump is not respecting that. And that's why our own Stat Harris poll found that 78% of Americans believe that the vaccine approval is being, that politics is coming before science when it comes to the vaccine approval process.
Ed Silverman, I want to thank you for being with us, senior writer and columnist at statnews.com. We're going to link to your latest piece, Everyone Was Left to Guess What Went Wrong, an open letter to AstraZeneca's CEO on transparency. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced by a remarkable team led by our general manager, Julie Crosby, Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tia Sena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, and Adriano Contreras. Also, special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Wear a mask, save lives.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The KBOO Program Advisory Committee has rescheduled their next meeting to Tuesday, September 15th at 6 p.m. KBOO open meetings are held online via video conferencing unless otherwise noted. More information about our Program Advisory Committee meetings and KBOO's open meeting policy can be found on our website at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio wants to know what you care about this election season. We want to ask our listeners one simple question. What do you think candidates should be talking about as they compete for votes? Let us know by filling out our Citizens Agenda survey, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa prepaid gift card. The responses we get from our community will inform our reporting on the November election. We want our coverage to serve our community, and we need your help to make it happen. If you would like to participate and be entered to win $50, go online to bit.ly/KBOOSurvey. Again, that's bit.ly/KBOOSurvey.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a program director to manage our programming department. This full-time position requires proven experience in program directing, radio audio production, management, and supervisory skills with volunteers, with an emphasis on teamwork and a collaborative setting, and the ability to work under strict deadlines. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. The deadline to apply for this position is Saturday, October 3rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm/employment.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, wildfires continue to rage throughout Oregon and the entire West Coast as smoke causes Portland's air quality to be rated the worst in the world. The fire threat causes Mayor Ted Wheeler to declare a state of emergency. And the Portland Police Bureau arrested a record number of protesters in the month of August. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, September 11th, 2020. I'm Nat Moon. Wildfires continue to grow in intensity today, resulting in unprecedented losses throughout the West Coast. At least 23 are believed to have died, and fears are that the number will increase as first responders return to devastated communities. In Oregon, over 1 million acres have been consumed, and tens of thousands of residents have been forced to evacuate. Thousands of homes have already been lost in a wildfire season of unprecedented proportions. In Clackamas County, the Beechey Creek and Riverside fires are expected to merge into one giant fire zone, threatening the towns of Estacada, Molalla, and Scotts Mills. Together, the two fires have so far consumed over 300,000 acres and prompted a series of Phase 3 go-now evacuation orders for the majority of the county. Oregon City and Canby are now at Phase 2, and residents have been advised to prepare to leave on very short notice. In a statement, Oregon Governor Kate Brown said, quote, "We have never seen this amount of uncontained fire across our state." And on Thursday night, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler declared a state of emergency. In Portland, today's blanket of smoke is so thick that the city's air quality was rated worst in the world. In Marion County, reports are that the town of Gates has been all but destroyed and that Mill City, Mahama, Lyons, and Detroit have all suffered significant damage. In Lane County, the Holiday Farm fire has reportedly leveled the town of Blue River, and in Jackson County, over 1,600 homes have been lost in the Alameda blaze. According to pyrogeographer Meg Krawchuk of Oregon State University, most of the state has not seen fires of this intensity for 300 to 400 years. Krawchuk said, quote, "It's very important to think in terms of learning from the situation right now, because we may be getting a glimpse of what our future may continue to be." Yesterday, Mayor Ted Wheeler declared a state of emergency for the city of Portland. The emergency declaration was announced due to the extreme fire risk and came just before 9 p.m. last night. Under the declaration, city parks, natural areas, and forests are closed to the general population. Houseless individuals are being directed to relocate to safer areas in the city, and evacuation sites are being prepared for fire victims or those displaced by the fire. In addition, the director of the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management will pursue all financial resources available. The emergency declaration will remain in effect until Thursday, September 24th. Earlier Thursday, U.S. Representative Peter DeFazio announced that the Federal Emergency Management Agency will provide financial assistance to Oregon. The authorization will provide funds to help fight fires in Clackamas County. It will also provide over $600,000 in mitigation assistance to the state. The money would help cover the cost of temporary housing as well. With over 500,000 Oregonians displaced from their homes due to evacuation orders, nonprofits around the state are mobilizing to provide support. In Salem, the Red Cross and the United Way of Mid-Willamette Valley are working out of a warehouse near the state fairgrounds. They're providing food, toiletries, and bedding to evacuees, many of whom were forced to flee with little more than what they were wearing. The location at 1705 Silverton Road Northeast was open from noon to 5 p.m. today, and weekend hours are planned. Donations of food, bedding, and other essentials can be dropped off at the United Way office at 455 Bliller Ave Northeast. They are not able to accept clothing or water at this time. The state of Oregon has asked the Salvation Army to provide 6,000 meals a day at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland, the state fairgrounds in Salem, and the Jackson County Expo in Central Point. The state's request comes in addition to the meals that the Salvation Army is already providing at the Lynn Benton Fairgrounds in Albany, the Douglas County Fairgrounds in Roseburg, and the Newport Recreation Center in Newport. Individuals wishing to volunteer are urged to contact their local Red Cross or Salvation Army. Monetary donations can be made online directly to the United Way of Mid-Willamette Valley and the Red Cross. It's not just humans that struggle with the wildfires. KBOO had the chance to speak with Michelle Feinberg from PETA, who had some advice on how best to take care of animals during the wildfires. Here she is with some tips.
To help keep your animal companion safe in case of a fire, you should have an animal emergency kit ready to go. So be sure to pack up a leash, a carrier, food bowls, and vet records. That way, if you have to evacuate suddenly, your animal's go bag is ready. And you'll also want to make sure your animal is microchipped and has up-to-date tags in case you're separated in the commotion. And most importantly, never leave animals behind or tear them loose outside. They won't be able to survive. So we urge you to go to PETA.org for more information on how to be prepared to keep your animal safe during a fire. PETA wants to remind everyone that anyone who evacuates and intentionally abandons animals to fend for themselves could be prosecuted. So make sure to plan accordingly so that you're not stuck in a bad situation unprepared. And to help with that, we offer a video about keeping animal companions safe during fires. So to watch it, just go to YouTube and search fire safety for dogs. If you do have to evacuate suddenly, to have a place to go that you know can accept animals. Animal companions aren't the only ones who can suffer in these wildfires. Animals used for food are often abandoned and left trapped in sheds where they can burn in the flames. And the best way to avoid contributing to their abuse and neglect is to go vegan. And you can learn all about that process and find the answers to all of your questions about vegan living regarding health, recipes, ingredients, products, sustainability, and more, all at PETA.org. If you're somewhere with a lot of smoke and falling ash, you'll want to keep your animals inside with you and avoid all outdoor activities like running with your dog. If visibility is less than 5 miles, it's a sign of unsafe air quality. So anyone who sees animals in distress and isn't able to get in there and help should note the animal's location and call their authorities immediately.
That was Michelle Feinberg with PETA.
In the Rogue Valley in southern Oregon, residents of the small towns of Phoenix and Talent are starting to pick up the pieces today after a devastating wildfire swept through the area 2 days ago. 600 homes were completely destroyed and at least one person was killed in the fire. A building housing a number of climate justice nonprofits was burned to the ground. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Ali Rosenbluth of Rogue Climate, one of the organizations that lost their office in this week's fire.
I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about what has happened in Talent over the last several days. We've heard about just massive destruction. How bad is it?
Yeah, so a few days ago, a fire was started near Bear Creek, and that fire quickly spread throughout the Rogue Valley because of really heavy winds that we were experiencing. The fire has gone through parts of North Ashland, most of the city of Talent, Phoenix, and parts of Medford as well. So there are, I think, about 600 houses that have been burned that they know of so far in these communities. And many people have been displaced and cannot get back to their homes. And it's not safe to enter Talent or Phoenix right now without an escort from the National Guard. There are gas mines that are still on fire.
And your organization, Rogue Climate, also lost your office. I understand it burned.
Yeah. The Rogue office, which is a shared space with the Rogue Action Center and many other social and climate justice organizations, grassroots groups, nonprofits, as a like hub for the organizing that happens in our valley. And that space has been completely burned down, including all of the years of community artwork. And, you know, we had tons of front page newspapers of the wins that we've had on the Jordan Cove LNG campaign. But all of our staff are safe. Many volunteers and community members have actually lost their homes. So right now at Rogue Climate, we're working with volunteers and community members, working on Meet for Our Whole Valley with other organizations, including the Rogue Action Center, Stowe Equity, Siskiyou Rising Tide, and so many more. We know that like our office was such a special place to work together, for us to plan, to dream, to laugh, to like build this vision that we had for the future. But that still exists, and we're still working together, and we're still working to build the future that we've always had in mind for the Rogue Valley.
And as far as what people have faced in Talent, I've seen some reports that the hardest hit areas were a couple of mobile home parks that were home to a lot of immigrants. Can you talk about the impact on the immigrant community?
This is having a, well, just like climate change, those are most impacted by these issues, right, tend to be immigrant communities, Black, Indigenous, and people of low-income communities, and we're seeing that play out right here, right now, in Southern Oregon. It, not just in Talent, but in Phoenix as well, are mobile home parks where a lot of Latinx folks lived, and they are have now been displaced. But there are some really incredible organizations that are working to support migrant farm workers who have been displaced, including the Northwest Seasonal Workers. And they're actually asking right now for donations. So you can mail donations to support the estimated 500 farm workers and migrant workers who have been displaced at 203 North Oakdale in Medford. If they can contribute right now, that would make a really big impact.
Has there been any information as to how the fire in Talent in Phoenix got started?
Yeah, the fire started in Ashland, North Ashland, and it went Route 99 through Talent Phoenix in North Medford. And there's been other fires that have popped up across the Rogue Valley as well. I don't think that they are quite sure how it started, but again, with climate change, experiencing these like hot, dry summers, it is incredibly easy for folks to make a mistake or for something to ignite and for that those flames to just take off. And so I think as we see the climate change, that we are going to experience more and more, and we have to remember that this was a choice that politicians and fossil fuel corporations made when they decided year after year after year after being asked to not take the action that we need to see for climate.
That was Allie Rosenbluth in Talent, Oregon, speaking with KABU's Jenka Soderberg. The full interview will be available on the KABU website later today, along with links to resources and places to donate. The website can be found at kabu.fm/eveningnews. Yesterday, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler announced that he is stepping back from the leadership of a number of the city's bureaus so that he can focus on police reform and the response to COVID-19. Wheeler gave up leadership of more than a half dozen city agencies, but will remain in charge of the Police Bureau, Housing Bureau, Office of Management and Finance, the Budget Office, the Attorney's Office, and the Office of Government Relations. In a letter to the other members of City Council, Wheeler said, quote, "The changes I'm making today allow me and my administration to focus on the most pressing issues facing our city." He went on to thank his colleagues for their willingness to take on an increased workload. As a result of the change, Commissioner Amanda Fritz will take on responsibility for Parks and Recreation and Environmental Services. Commissioner Chloe Udaly will lead the Office for Community Technology, and Commissioner Joanne Hardesty will add the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability to her responsibilities. Newly elected Commissioner Dan Ryan will take over the Joint Office of Homeless Services. The new lineup will remain in place until January 3rd, when Commissioner Fritz's term ends and Commissioner-elect Carmen Rubio steps in. But both Mayor Wheeler and Commissioner Udaly are up in challenging re-election races this November, so it's possible there will be additional changes come January. Although July's confrontations between protesters and federal agents may have created more cable news drama, August saw an all-time record in the number of protest-related arrests in the city of Portland. Jail records and press releases show that the Portland Police Bureau made 295 arrests last month, and 256 of those arrests included the all-purpose charge of interfering with a peace officer. 188 included a charge of disorderly conduct. Both are misdemeanors, which newly elected Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt has said he will decline to pursue unless they are associated with more serious charges such as theft, property damage, or use of force like assault. Of those arrested, nearly 15% were listed as repeat offenders, and the ages of those arrested ranged from 15 to 60. The numbers also don't include two high-profile cases during the protests. Marquise Love turned himself in after being accused of attacking a pickup truck driver, and Michael Rinell was killed by federal agents during a supposed arrest attempt in Lacey, Washington. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Coming up next at 5:30, it's Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sana Lee. Then at 7, The Struggle with Alyssa Pariah. Due to heavy smoke from multiple wildfires, an air quality alert is in effect until noon on Monday across much of Western Oregon. Individuals are advised to limit outdoor activities, and children and people with heart or lung conditions are advised to remain indoors. Tonight, we can expect unhealthy air and an overnight low of about 55. Tomorrow, we'll see a smoky day with high temperatures in the low to mid 80s. On this day in 2001, terrorists hijacked four airliners, striking the World Trade Centers in New York City and the Pentagon in Washington, D.C. The fourth crashed in a field in central Pennsylvania after passengers stormed the cockpit. The attacks killed nearly 3,000 people. Today's quote is from Sandy Dahl, the wife of United Flight 93 pilot Jason Dahl. She said, quote, "If we learn nothing else from this tragedy, we learn that life is short and there is no time for hate." While Joe Biden was campaigning in Michigan, President Trump was defending his own downplaying of the threat of COVID-19. Meanwhile, Microsoft has warned that Russian agents are once again wading into the U.S. general election. With more on those stories and others, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Politicians should be using their platform to unify our response and amplify the voice of science.
Family doctor Glenn Hurst chairs the Iowa Democratic Party's Rural Caucus. Yesterday, he and infectious disease expert Christy Peterson joined Democrats in the Hawkeye State, asking Republican Senator Joni Ernst to do more to dispel the false charges she promoted last week, that COVID deaths were overestimated and healthcare professionals were purposefully inflating coronavirus case numbers for profit.
I took offense because of my time spent as a provider in a nursing home that suffered an outbreak that affected almost the entire staff and the population of a 41-bed nursing home.
In fact, it costs more to treat COVID-19 patients, and by far more people who have died also had chronic underlying diseases, but those were not the imminent cause of death. Ernst later walked it back in a statement to the Washington Post. She's up for re-election. President Donald Trump defended his early public dismissal of the risks of the pandemic. He tried to deflect blame onto Washington Post journalist Bob Woodward, who interviewed him this winter, saying the journalist should have told the public at the time if he disagreed.
You don't want me jumping up and down, screaming, there's going to be great death, and really causing some very, very serious problems for the country.
Observers point out that it's possible to stay calm and take action to avert tragedy, as leaders in some other countries have done. At a campaign stop in Florida, Senator Kamala Harris, Joe Biden's running mate, said the president failed in the, quote, very important and special responsibility, unquote, to keep the American people safe.
He had all this information, yet he held rallies. He suggested that to wear a mask is a sign of weakness as opposed to a sign of strength.
Recent polls show the battleground state is a toss-up between President Trump and former Vice President Biden. Damian Filer with Progress Florida says close elections are common there.
It is the single biggest opportunity to collect electoral college votes in a state that you really can't predict the outcome.
Biden is still ahead by 17 points in Miami-Dade County, Florida's most populous county and historically a Democratic stronghold. But Trump has made gains. Meanwhile, Microsoft warned the Russian military intelligence unit responsible for the 2016 attacks on the Democratic National Committee is still active, this time targeting both parties' campaigns and consultants. The The former head of Homeland Security's Intelligence Division and now whistleblower, Brian Murphy, says he was ordered to focus on foreign interference by China and Iran rather than Russia and downplay the threat of white supremacy at home. Adam Clayton Powell leads the University of Southern California's cybersecurity initiative.
We really do have to guard against a broad array of threats. Our adversaries, particularly Russia, are very inventive. They are well-funded, well-staffed, and they conduct research.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
The Gwich'in tribe has sued the Trump administration to protect the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge from oil and gas development. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Gwich'in tribes filed a lawsuit Wednesday against the Trump administration over oil and gas development in the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Gwich'in people have long fought drilling in the area they hold sacred to protect cultural and subsistence resources. Last month, the Interior Department approved oil and gas leasing in the coastal plain. Supporters of development include Alaska state leaders and Alaska's congressional delegation for jobs and economic boosts. The Village of Venati Tribal Government, Arctic Village Council, and Venati Village Council filed the lawsuit, represented by the Native American Rights Fund. 15 states, led by Washington, filed a separate lawsuit Wednesday. High winds and dry conditions continue to fan flames on the Colville Reservation in Washington State. In addition to destroying several structures, the fire is taking a toll on livestock. Ashley Abrahamson with the Tribal Fish and Wildlife Department estimates the fire has killed as many as 2,500 head of cattle and up to 100 horses.
We can't even bring them in because they're so burnt. We have to put them down in the pasture, and that's just from what we can recover as of right now. Until the hot spots disappear, we're still counting. People are losing their homes left and right here. And it's just getting worse.
The Okanagan County Fairground is sheltering livestock and other animals, but is in need of feed. The cause of the fire remains under investigation. The Navajo Nation reported its second day of no additional COVID-19 deaths in 3 days. As Christine Trudeau reports, months after strict orders, health officials report dwindling numbers of new cases.
Twice within a matter of days, the Navajo Nation marked a significant milestone that the nation's largest reservation hasn't seen since March. It's all the more important as the tribe continues to climb toward a total number that nears 10,000 COVID-19 deaths. The nation once outpaced every state in the country for the number of deaths from the disease. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez called it good news, but cautioned the numbers will continue to fluctuate until there is an effective vaccine. Nez encouraged citizens not to get discouraged by the fluctuation, but to stay on top of practicing all healthcare expert-recommended safety measures and reminded that it's due to sticking to these measures that new case numbers have dropped. In addition to remaining vigilant, Navajo Nation Council Delegate Amber Kinesba-Crotty says the council continue to push Navajo Nation programs for a dramatic increase to funds and resources for every community across Navajo Nation. Navajo Nation health officials originally reported no new cases for a day, but that was later corrected to add 12 additional cases. Following Labor Day weekend gatherings, another spike in case numbers is expected. Another 32-hour partial weekend lockdown will go into effect starting Saturday. I'm Christine Trudeau.
This story is a collaboration with National Native News and the Solutions Journalism Network. A Native coalition is calling for the Kansas City football team to end its use of Native American stereotypes and the misappropriation of Native culture as the NFL season starts. In August, the team announced new measures and policies, which include banning fans from wearing headdresses into the stadium and Indian-themed face paint. The team says it's reviewing the use of the arrowhead chop. The coalition, Not in Our Honor, says the steps are in the right direction, but it does not address the overall racism and appropriation of Native culture using a race of people as a mascot. The coalition was formed by Native college students and includes Native advocates, educators, and community leaders. They're calling for the end of the chop, team name, and imagery. Meanwhile, Kansas City kicked off the 2020 season against the Houston Texans Thursday night. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new report says that enrollment in college has dropped off significantly for Black Americans, in large part as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. With more on that, here's Mike Moen with the Public News Service.
The pandemic has brought a host of disparities for Black Americans, and college enrollment could be among them. A Minnesota advocacy group says the health crisis might add to existing barriers facing students in the region. The latest findings from the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center show summer college enrollment for Black undergrad students dropped by more than 8% in the U.S. Jonathan McNichols is state chair of Students United, a nonprofit that advocates for students in Minnesota's state university system. He says there's already anecdotal evidence of Black students being affected by the crisis.
I know a few of my friends who have dropped out or have taken more gaps in their education in order to work more away from the pandemic, just decide to know if they are going to be able to effectively continue their education.
He notes that Black student enrollment across state schools is already significantly low, and a report this year from the Education Trust gave the University of Minnesota a failing grade in this area. That report looked at 2017 numbers. The school says it has made improvements since that time. McNichols and others say while summer classes might not be as crucial when compared to other semesters, they anticipate these gaps extending into the fall. He says that would make it even harder for many Black students to resume their college careers if they take a pause.
You start growing your life to a spot that it's harder to return to higher education. It's harder to become a student after you have these commitments in your life.
He says students of color don't often have the same level of resources as their white counterparts, which could keep them in the workforce rather than returning to school. McNichols hopes this convinces more policymakers and schools to take steps to reduce the cost of higher education. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
A member of Norway's far-right Progressive Party has nominated Donald Trump for a Nobel Peace Prize. Lawmaker Christian Tybring-Gjedde said that Trump deserves consideration for his efforts in Western Asia. This is not the first time that Tybring-Gjedde has nominated Trump. In 2018, he cited the Donald's efforts to bring North and South Korea together. To Trump's great disappointment, that nomination also failed to gain traction with the Nobel Committee. Even Tybring-Gjedde's own family didn't support the nomination. His daughter Mathilde is also a member of the Norwegian Parliament. In an email to CBS News,